What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Hi guys, welcome to the Katie Halper Show. I'm recording in a very loud place because I just recorded a live radio show with Matt Taibbi and Aaron Mate. And usually I record my podcast and then play it on the radio. But today, because we're in a time of breaking news and breaking narratives like Russiagate, I came into the studio. So here is a podcast of a chat that I had with Aaron Mate and Matt Taibbi live on WBAI. And if you like this and you like to actually be able to hear Russiagate skeptics like Matt and Aaron and my other guests like Max Blumenthal and Rania Mate and Rania Kallik, because there's no such thing as Rania Mate, but I'm all distracted, please become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, it's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Thanks so much. See you next week. And I'll also be providing you with a bonus episode with Matt Taibbi.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. So excited to be here. You can hear the Katie Halper Show at our new time, which is Tuesdays at 11 a.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 FM or WBAI.org. And we have a great show for you coming up today. Some of you may have heard of this thing called Russiagate. The media talks about it sometimes. You may have heard there's an entire network dedicated to it called MSNBC. That forgot that other things in the world were happening. They just talk about Russiagate. And today I'm bringing you some great journalists, men who have gone where no men have gone before, or at least have gone where few men have gone before, or few men and women have gone before, which is into the realm of Russiagate skepticism. We're going to talk about that with them. As most people would admit, they've been vindicated. But some people in the media are still in denial. But I'm going to let them explain it. So the first person we're talking to is the award-winning journalist Matt Taibbi at Rolling Stone. Do we have Matt on the – okay, we're getting to Matt. You see, this is how in demand these guys are. We also have another number for him that he just gave me, which is right here. See, we're giving you this espionage vibe, this thriller suspense thing, because we wanted it to match with the Russiagate narrative, except for unlike Russiagate, there actually is a kind of suspenseful thing going on here. But yeah, Matt Taibbi has a great piece in at Rolling Stone, and it's called As the Mueller Probe Ends, New Russiagate Myths Begin. Donald Trump couldn't have asked for a juicier 2020 campaign issue. This is the beauty of live radio. Everyone, by the way, go open up if you're in front of the internet. You can go to the Rolling Stone, look at Taibbi's piece. It's great. And it opens with, on Sunday, Attorney General William Barr sent a letter to Congress summarizing the findings of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. The most telling section, quoted directly from Mueller's report, read, quote, "The investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities," end quote. That one sentence should end a roughly 33-month national ordeal, the first Russiagate stories date back to July 2016, in which the public was encouraged, both by officials and the press, to believe Donald Trump was a compromised foreign agent. So we got Matt Taibbi, we got Aaron Mate, not to be confused with each other, although you could be like Aaron Matt Taibbi. That's what we could call them as an investigative team. These two guys have been done amazing work. Aaron Mate is a journalist at The Nation. He used to be a co-host at Democracy Now! He also used to be a producer and journalist with The Real News. And they've both been, you know what's interesting is that they've both been really smeared for just being skeptical people, and they're dismissed as, ironically, people who are skeptical about Russiagate are ironically dismissed as conspiracy theorists. And of course, it couldn't be further from the truth, because these are people who are actually skeptics and waiting for evidence to appear before they come to a conclusion. So I think we do have on the line Aaron. Is that true?
Hello.
Hi, Aaron. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. You are the one, I think you're probably the person who's most associated with Russiagate skepticism. And you've tolerated a lot for that. You've paid the price for that. Can you explain to listeners where we are right now in the Russiagate investigation?
Where we are is that the conspiracy theory has collapsed. I mean, for 2 years, the dominant narrative has been that Trump is in cahoots with Russia. He engaged in a conspiracy with them. He's possibly compromised by them. And that Robert Mueller was going to uncover it. Robert Mueller was going to uncover the smoking gun. And Robert Mueller has just rendered his verdict. He didn't. He found no evidence of a Trump-Russia conspiracy. That's no surprise to those of us who looked at the available evidence, which is what journalism is supposed to do. You go based on not where your imagination takes you, but what the actual facts tell you. And the facts from the beginning told us a very, you know, clear story that the case for this Trump-Russia collusion theory was just not there.
Right. What is the – I guess I want to know what you thought would happen. And what were your predictions?
I predicted a while ago that, you know, look, this result was not a surprise at all, again, based on the available facts. And just the plausibility of the underlying theory to begin with, that Trump, this reality TV show host who didn't even look like he really thought he would win, engage in a conspiracy with Russia, or that he was compromised by Russia. It just wasn't there. It didn't make sense as an idea, and it didn't make sense based on the facts we knew. So my prediction was always that, and I said this a while ago, that there would be zero indictments or claims of a Trump-Russia conspiracy, but that Mueller might throw, those who are hanging on to that idea a bone, especially because there was so much put on his shoulders. He was turned into this, like, revered saint. And he does come from a D.C. establishment that does resent Trump, not for the reasons that, you know, I think you or I do and our listeners might, but based on his actual harmful policies, but because they think that he is a crude representative of the establishment.
So it's not
president.
Aaron, I just want to clarify. We do we still believe, given that what's happened, do we still believe that Mueller wears Brooks Brothers suits? Because,
well, yeah, I mean, like, that was part of the like PR campaign to like revere Mueller and to paint him as this like saintly figure and talking about what clothes he wears and his background and so forth.
Right.
And that was at a time when everybody thought he was going to deliver a verdict that Trump had committed treason. Now that Mueller has delivered the opposite verdict, I mean, Mueller is no longer being glorified in this way. And there's even an article in the New York Times saying that some Democrats are reconsidering their act of putting him on a pedestal. But anyway,
right.
my prediction was that Mueller would throw them a bone. And I think, so my prediction was, first of all, that Mueller would not find a Trump-Russia conspiracy. So that borne out pretty well. And then it was also that Mueller would throw those who expected a conspiracy a bone. And I think this is my theory here, but that's what Mueller's decision was when it comes to obstruction, because he didn't make a decision. He basically left it open, which then leaves it open for speculation. When really, I mean, it's strange for after a 2-year investigation for a prosecutor to defer like this. And I'd be curious to hear what Matt Taibbi has to say about that. But I think that basically in punting on obstruction, that was Mueller's way of like of leaving something open that people could hang on to, while still not giving them anything. Because, of course, if Mueller actually thought that Trump committed obstruction, he could have alleged it.
Right. Well, we are going to take a very short break because we want to bring Matt Taibbi on to talk with you and talk to us. We're going to play a really appropriate, if I do say so, song. Hate to say I Told You So by The Hives. Hate to say I told you so, all right. And that was The Hive singing Hate to Say I Told You So, which we're playing for reasons you may be able to put together. So excited to have two amazing guests on the show. Kind of really honestly couldn't ask for better guests to be talking about Russiagate. We have with us Aaron Mate, a Nation magazine journalist, former host of The Real News and producer at The Real News. And we have with us also, joining us right now, Matt Taibbi, the award-winning Rolling Stone journalist. So welcome, Matt and Aaron.
Thanks for having us on.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello. So congratulations, by the way, to both of you.
Well,
for your skepticism.
I guess.
Yeah.
You know, it seems a little, I mean, this is going to continue for years and years and years. So
right.
It's a little early to be doing the touchdown spike, I think.
Right.
Yeah, and listen, the only actual victory here is Trump's because, you know, as we've been warning for 2 years, this whole thing, you know, focusing on this conspiracy theory was only setting up the resistance up for failure because
right.
the evidence wasn't there. And eventually the facts had to come out. Mueller has just done that with his verdict. And now, of course, Trump is understandably, and as we predicted, using this for his reelection campaign.
Right.
So the only possible victory here for politics and for journalism is if there's accountability, and is if we learn from this, and on the journalism front is if we learn to actually follow the facts, not a narrative that benefits ratings and gets us clicks. And politics, if we actually learn to start becoming an actual real resistance, mounting Trump, mounting an opposition to Trump. Based on opposing his policies, not based on believing in this fairy tale.
Right. And I wanted to give you guys both the chance to respond to this premise, which is a false one, which is that if you question the Russiagate narrative, you're somehow helping Trump. Or who would question Russiagate unless they are trying to cover Trump's butt or trying to downplay how destructive he is? So, Aaron, you kind of got into that, but I want to ask you, Matt, also what your response to that is.
Well, I agree completely with everything that Aaron said, and in fact, in I believe it was March of 2017, way at the beginning of this, I wrote an article basically saying the same things, that this story was a real minefield for both Democratic voters and the Democratic Party, but particularly for journalists, because Donald Trump had already made it such an important part of his message that journalists were out to get him,
right.
that there were representatives of the elite who would stop at nothing to undermine his presidency. And to me, it seemed the only way that we could possibly, you know, sort of lose with the public in a contest with somebody like Donald Trump is if we completely abdicated the standards of the profession and did what he accused us of doing, which would be politicizing our jobs, using sort of trumped up evidence to try to make him look bad. That was the one option that, you know, out of an infinite number of ways we could have pursued covering his presidency. That was the one thing that could have really helped him. And we did it. We not only did we do it, but we did it basically to the exclusion of almost everything else
right.
for years.
And what are some of the things that were excluded, like at the cost of, because of Russiagate? What were some of the important stories that the public was kind of deprived of?
Aaron, you want to take that? Or
I mean, literally, I would say everything. I remember watching Rachel Maddow the day that the Congress had taken a huge step forward to, you know, taking away the health insurance of millions of Americans. And I think she gave it like, you know, like about 30 seconds and moved on to some element of the conspiracy theory that ended up, of course, being totally debunked. I mean, we can go on and on and on about what was not covered. I mean,
right.
there's the MSNBC didn't mention Yemen for, I think, about a year.
What's Yemen? Where in Russia is Yemen?
At a time when the U.S. was taking part in a genocide and killing tens of thousands of people through the Saudi bombing campaign and the famine that campaign was causing. I mean, even also, I mean, one of the most crucial things it ignored was the serious escalation of tensions between the U.S. and Russia that Trump was overseeing through carrying out policies that were far more hawkish than Obama. Well, we haven't focused on those, I think, partly because but it's partly because they're supported by the bipartisan foreign policy consensus in Washington, and the media generally goes along with that. But also because to acknowledge those policies and look at them seriously would undercut this idea that everybody bought onto that Trump was doing Putin's bidding.
Right. Matt, do you have any favorite ignored stories?
I mean, I think there was a very telling moment for me when a story came out where, you know, every year the Pentagon is responsible under the terms of the each year's National Defense Authorization Act. They have to submit a memo that's usually not made public, but it speaks to which countries where we have active combat operations in. And in, I believe it was early 2017, they released one that said that we had active operations in seven countries. So I did a little story basically saying, hey, has anybody noticed that we're at war in Niger and Somalia and Yemen and Syria and, you know, Afghanistan? In other words, just the idea that we've started new military campaigns, and this can fly completely under the radar with the public because of this story. It just speaks to the enormity of this story and how much oxygen it took up. It took up everything. We didn't have time for anything else.
Right. And how much did the goading of Trump, I mean, you have Democrats, Howard Dean, for instance, not that he's that relevant, although he's more relevant than he should be. But you have Congressman Adam Schiff, all these people kind of goading Trump and mocking him as, you know, Putin's boyfriend or being too close to Putin. And then, as you guys have both mentioned, you have Trump policies that are quite hawkish, right? How much has this provided cover or even incentive for Trump to be more hawkish, to kind of prove that he's not politically in bed with Putin?
Well,
yeah, I mean, one of the things that I said early on in some of these pieces was the one supreme danger. Like, if you, on the day that Donald Trump was elected, the very first thing that should have come to everybody's mind was, you know, if we have no other priority in terms of activism for the next 4 years, most important thing is to keep Donald Trump away from any kind of decision that would involve nuclear combat.
Right.
Like that would be the number one consideration that anybody should make. And yet, when Donald Trump decided, and I think this is in his character a little bit, he's not, even though he likes to think of himself as great at war, he does have this sort of natural reluctance to get into military conflicts in places, or at least, you know, politically so. When he talked about getting out of Syria, we should have been encouraging that. Like, you know, no matter what you think about Syria or what you think our policy should be there, the reality is that the commander-in-chief that we have is not the person you want to be sending troops into a combat zone where there are Russians on the other side.
Right.
You know, I mean, the Russian-American troops are sitting across the Euphrates River from each other, and a couple of bad drunken incidents could trigger nuclear combat.
Right.
And that to me was nuts.
Yeah, is this? I mean, I've said this a lot before, and I don't really know the answer. I don't know if any of us does, but you guys probably may. But what is the end game, right? Because you have people saying that Trump is a megalomaniac with dementia, who's erratic, who stole the election thanks to Russians, and the same people say that Putin is a megalomaniac and evil, and they both have their finger on the buttons, and they want Trump to stop being so soft, right? They want Trump to ratchet things up with Putin. So what is the end game that they imagine?
They imagine no end game. This whole thing was incoherent. They're accusing Trump of doing Putin's bidding while he consistently does the opposite, while he, you know, tries to overthrow Putin's ally in Venezuela, while he bombs Putin's ally in Syria twice. pulls out of the INF treaty, setting off a whole new nuclear arms race. I mean, great. So basically, the end game, the actual end game in real life, is existential peril.
Right.
Because we are risking, nuclear accidents and the threat of war based on these hawkish policies.
Right.
But that doesn't matter to those who profited off of the Russiagate narrative, to failed neoliberal democratic elites who needed an excuse to cover up the fact that they lost to Donald Trump, to FBI, to intelligence officials who opened up this investigation on very specious grounds, and who suspected Trump in part because he was saying nice things about Vladimir Putin.
Right.
And whether you agree with that or not, to lay that as a predicate for a counterintelligence investigation is just extraordinary. And then there was the media, which of course got a lot of ratings and clicks by spinning this real life spy thriller.
Right.
If I could interject there too, I think there was an element of Russiagate, and still is, that does have a logic to it. I think it's a very dark logic. If you saw what happened in 2016, the political situation was sort of the ruling neoliberal consensus was under fire from all sides. From radical right movements, both in the United States and in Europe, from leftist movements, both in the United States and in Europe. The overwhelming voter sentiment everywhere had to do with the rejection of sort of international global consensus. You saw votes like Brexit, which was a complete repudiation of a number of things. But Russiagate as a political solution, as a response to that electoral phenomenon, has been extraordinarily effective because what it's done is it's completely changed the attitude of a huge portion of the population, which now sees as its only savior the very, sort of international security services, the international sort of global consensus. They see them as the saviors who are going to rescue them from the evil Trump, and therefore we have to pursue this case and celebrate authoritarianism and celebrate the FBI and the CIA and their heroism and the EU and everything and NATO. So it's this story has had some benefit from a propaganda perspective as well.
So you think that people think that the intelligence community and the military-industrial complex are these things are going to, the theory goes that they will just get, they'll stop Trump from getting his finger on the button? Like, so they're not, because Aaron, you said existential peril, which does seem like one option. Do you think the people who are pushing this narrative, which does potentially lead to existential peril, are they just counting on some kind of, the adults in the room taking over from Trump or something?
Well, I mean, that was part of this narrative, which is that we were, as Matt is saying, that we're supposed to revere and trust in intelligence officials, forgetting their actual record, which includes giving us one of the biggest crimes of, in recent memory, the Iraq War.
I mean,
they're the ones who spun the funny intel about WMDs. And also promoting this notion that fundamentally undermines the idea of a democratic government, where it's the elected president, whether you like that person or not, who's supposed to make the decisions, not unelected, intelligence bureaucrats. And to illustrate Matt's point about how this, diverted liberal energy, let's look at one of the biggest protests of the Trump era. It was not over Trump taking away health care.
Right.
It was not over Trump and the GOP pushing through this tax cut that was, I think, the biggest upward transfer of wealth in U.S. history. It was to protect Robert Mueller. Just a few months ago, we had marches in Times Square and D.C. all over the country about protecting Mueller, when he actually seriously, at least for the last long while, has not been under threat, as I think Barr's summary just makes clear, that the Justice Department never interfered with anything he wanted to do. But yet, protecting Robert Mueller from this a threat we perceived him to be under, that all of a sudden is one of the biggest causes for a massive national rally instead of what Trump is actually doing.
I'm going to have to push back on that and say that you are eclipsing the other very important resistance movement, which was to save Jeff Beauregard Sessions,
That's what elicited this march. So the day after Sessions was forced to step down, that's what this march was over. So right. We were basically marching for Jeff Sessions' job.
Right.
And if you compare that march to what we saw, see, in the very first days of the Trump administration, we had the Muslim ban. And that was right before Russiagate had totally taken over. Right. And then what did we see? We saw people going to airports and standing up to this really cruel Trump policy and doing something about it. Well, where was the energy ever since then? And I think there's a strong correlation between the rise of Russiagate throughout the resistance and the decline in activism that we saw right before Russiagate really exploded.
Right. You're listening to The Katie Halper Show. I'm speaking to the wonderful journalist Matt Taibbi, the award-winning journalist at Rolling Stone. Also, Aaron Mate, the hardest working man in Russiagate showbiz, also a journalist at The Nation and former host and producer at The Real News. So we're also going to take your calls at the end of the show. And if you would like to ask us questions, talk to me, Matt, or Aaron, you can call 212-209-2877. Again, that's 212-209-2877. So we talked a little bit about Russiagate and the known knowns and the known unknowns and the unknown knowns. Let's talk a little bit about the role of media. I wanted to know, maybe we could kind of pay homage to the worst Russiagate players, because it's really
there's too many.
There's too many.
There's
I know,
many
right? I know. We're gonna have to have a marathon, a 24-hour marathon, where we go through all of them. But what? Who do you think?
I mean, yeah. Look, the central figure is Rachel, unfortunately.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how you
how to avoid. We're speaking of Rachel Maddow, who is a Rhodes. Not. I don't want to be a snob about this, but she is a Rhodes Scholar. If anything, I'm probably being an anti-snob. I'm like undoing centuries of stereotypes about Rhodes Scholars. But yes, this woman is, I mean, Rachel Maddow is very intelligent, right? No one doubts her intelligence.
I knew Rachel, you know, going back to the Air America days.
Right.
We used to be friends. And I always thought she was smart, funny,
yeah.
You know, skeptical.
Yep.
And
did she rub her hands together in real life like she does on TV?
I don't remember that, okay. But she had some things that we disagreed about, you know, especially on things like involving the military.
Right.
She, you know, I'm kind of more of a pacifist than she
right.
is, but this transformation, you know, where she started to play this character on television.
Right.
That's like something out of, I forget what the Andy Griffith movie is, but you know it's like a modern day Glenn Beck act,
right?
And I it's been shocking to watch her embrace that role in the way that she has. I don't know if you feel the same way, Aaron, but it's been very scary to me.
When I wrote a piece 2 years ago, 2 years ago next month, I wrote a piece for The Intercept, just looking at her coverage, even back as early as back then, about how Russia was being covered above everything else. And it was being done in a way that was ignoring all the countervailing developments that undercut her conspiracy theory, which she had already jumped onto. That basically says she was being a propagandist. I noted that it's what a tragedy it was, because I've always thought she's a really gifted journalist. She was dubbed the smartest person on TV. And I think, yeah, there was a time when I probably found that plausible. I mean, I used to be a stan of hers.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's been tragic to watch. And I mean, you can't ignore the fact, you can't ignore the reality of what she's become, which is just a straight up propagandist who has, you know, not interviewed a single dissenting voice and basically not acknowledged any of the countervailing facts. And that is why, I mean, I actually tuned in to her show last night, her first show since the summary of Mueller's findings was released. And after more than 2 years of promoting this idea of a Trump-Russia conspiracy, she gave the Mueller finding that there was no Trump-Russia conspiracy. She gave it 30 seconds.
Mm.
She gave it 30 seconds. She basically read out the summary, the findings from Mueller's report. And then she moved on to obstruction for the rest of the hour. Because now, of course, obstruction is the thing that that Maddow and everybody else who promoted the Russia conspiracy theory are going to cling to now in a bit to cover up for the fact that their conspiracy theory failed.
Right. Yeah.
And if I could just add to the, you know, the cable stations have played a very particular role in this whole business, which has been to scare people, right? Like, you know, all propaganda works on multiple levels, but there has to be an emotional component to things in order for it to really sell, because you have to be able to turn people's minds off when it comes to this stuff. So the combination that worked here was the emotional devastation of liberal audiences. People, you know, people were crushed when Donald Trump was elected. You know, I'm sure you've talked to people who likened it to 9/11 or, you know, losing a family member. But it was a combination of that plus being told over and over again, we are under attack. There are Russians in our midst. You may not even be aware of them. They may be working in your office. They may turn off your heat in the middle of the winter. You know, people on some level, they register this stuff, and it turns their brain, it turns their minds off to alternative possibilities. And that is a particularly low form of media activity, and they didn't just indulge in it, they turned it into an art form with the story, that was shocking to watch too.
Yeah.
That, you know, I'll never forget, Maddow did a segment where she was talking about some alleged Russian trolls interfering on Bernie Sanders' San Diego fan club's Facebook page, and she talks about this potential Russian troll activity on this Facebook fan page for Bernie Sanders in San Diego, and then she says, this is international warfare against our country.
That Bernie Sanders lovers page run out of Albania, it's still there, still running, still operating, still churning this stuff out. Now, this is not part of American politics. This is not, you know, partisan warfare between Republicans and Democrats. This is international warfare against our country. And it did not end on Election Day. We are still in it.
It's like, it's that kind of stuff. And then I'll also never forget Rob Reiner, who helped found Hollywood neocon group, Hollywood / neocon alliance called the Committee to Investigate Russia. Rob Reiner on MSNBC, I'll try to find this clip and tweet it out. He said that the Russians are in our bloodstream.
That authoritarianism has entered the bloodstream of America, and it is very subtle.
It's in our bloodstream, he said.
So it's insidious, and it has affected our bloodstream.
So, I mean, there's a huge psychological dimension to all this. And
No, the New York Times also did an infographic online where they actually expanded upon that theme, and they described the Russian threat as a virus that was literally taking over your body at the cellular level and changing your chemistry, your body chemistry. It's a very elaborate graphic, and you know that people, even intelligent people, will be moved by this stuff.
I know, it's really it's very scary. I mean, I feel like I've been dropping my definite articles without even realizing it. It's affecting my speech pattern.
Yeah, and this is just a quickly, I mean, this is a part of, this is not, obviously did not start in 2016. I mean, Matt has written about this. I mean, in terms of, you know, being in our bloodstream, well, like, Russophobia is in the bloodstream of American political culture. It goes back a century where, you know, for decades, it's been the Russians invading us and manipulating us and turning our young people into dupes and planting propaganda in our heads. And I don't think that's why this Russiagate thing, it could not have happened with any other country. There's a reason we don't hear about Israelgate or Saudi Gate.
Oh, right, which we have to bring up Israel.
It particularly survives on this very entrenched Cold War mindset that way predates 2016.
Well, you know,
which I'm sorry to interrupt, which is another reason why there was a lot of conscious conflation of the Russian Federation and the Soviet Union that went on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can still today go onto the Mother Jones website and see images of Vladimir Putin, but it'll have a hammer and sickle next to it.
I know. I wish. Don't get my hopes up, guys.
And
the left
you know, the The Jonathan Shade story that claims that, you know, he's been an agent since 1987 when, you know, again, it was a different country back then.
Right.
Donna Brazile talking about how the communists have gotten into dictating the debate.
Right.
They want us to forget the distinction because they want us to remember that those archaic fears we had back in the
right.
days when the day after was the big scare story.
Right. The idea that the problem is that, you know, Trump is being influenced by a communist internationalist who is trying to make, you know, as we can see from the redistribution of wealth that Trump is exacting in the United States. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all. But, you know, Aaron,
I want to make.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, listen, let me make a quick amendment. I want to say, because I love mocking Chris Hayes. I think Chris Hayes is very smart, very bright. I think he knows exactly what he's doing.
Mm.
It was the Jonathan Chait / Chris Hayes story. Because after Jonathan Chait came out with a story about is Trump a Russian military intelligence agent, then Chris Hayes put Chait on his program that night and they discussed it as if this was a serious prospect.
Right. Has either of you, I mean, Aaron, you haven't been on Freudian slip. You have been on WBI. You're on WBI right now. But have you been on MSNBC? And Matt, when's the last time you were on MSNBC?
You know, it's funny. The last time I was on MSNBC, I was on with Malcolm Nance.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was on to talk about this issue. And I was on with Chris Hayes. And it, what was really funny was, you know, I said something that I thought was a completely sort of anodyne conservative comment, which was, well, there's two versions of the, well, it's not just two versions. There's multiple versions of the story. There's a scenario where, you know, there was some kind of foreign interference that went on. There's another scenario where it went on, and Donald Trump was, you know, involved with it. And I said, those two stories, if those are the two options that they're looking at right now. And I didn't even get into the fact that it hadn't really been established that the Russians had done it. But I said, those two stories are orders of magnitude different, and the media has to make an important distinction between the two, that one doesn't prove the other. And that was why I was never invited on again after that.
Wow. Yeah.
And when was that, Matt?
That was in, I think, January of 2017, right at the beginning of this whole thing. And
okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, just say, if that's the date, then that means that was the January 2017, basically right as Trump was taking office, was the last time someone who was skeptical from the left of this whole Russiagate thing was allowed on MSNBC. Because in December 2016, I remember Ari Melber interviewed Glenn Greenwald. But that was the last time for Glenn. And if that's the last time for Matt, then that means that basically throughout this entire affair, Trump's presidency, MSNBC has not allowed on a single dissenting voice. I mean, that's extraordinary.
It's in our bloodstream, as you guys have pointed out. So we could have had some, like, Manchurian guests on the show without even knowing it.
But right, the funny thing is, Katie, the group is so small that has you know, publicly talked about this.
Right.
You can count us on
a couple of hands. Two hands? Yeah.
It's basically two hands.
Right.
We all know each other. We're in constant contact with each other because we have to be.
Right.
And, you know, none of us, they won't invite us. Nobody's going to invite us on television.
Right. Yeah.
And what does that say, by the way? What does that say about a political media culture?
Well, let's, speaking of political media. I just want to make sure we have people on the line, and because our media culture is different from MSNBC, I want to let the people ask some questions. But Aaron, do you want to finish your point, then we'll open it to questions?
Yeah. What does it say about our media political culture that the amount of – that it's somehow a fringe position.
Yeah, exactly.
To question the idea of a conspiracy between the president and Russia.
Right.
It's such a fringe position that the number of people who question that, who challenge it, and in a trade that is about – looking at the available facts and scrutinizing them, that position is so fringe that you can count it on one or two hands. It's crazy.
Well, okay. The number, by the way, again, is 212-209-2877. We're taking calls, 212-209-2877. And we already have some people coming in. Hello.
Hi. I don't know what number to call. I have $400 that I want to donate.
Oh. Okay, let's see. Call 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. Is this in the name of the Katie Halper Show? Just kidding. I mean, yes, but...
Yeah, what is it? I'm sorry.
516-620-3602. But you can also email Linda.
No, I don't have a computer.
Okay, she doesn't have a computer. So call. So we're going to pick you that up now. Awesome. Great. Any questions besides that very important one, which really is important and helpful? So thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm just a little slow. So could you say it one more time?
Sure.
Slow.
516-620-3602.
Okay. Yeah, I'd like to give $400. I just didn't know who to call.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. So you have the number now.
Okay.
Any questions about Russiagate?
No, I'll just make this call
okay.
right now.
Okay, thank you so much. Thanks
You're
a lot.
You're welcome.
Okay, any other calls? This was not that was not a plan, by the way. Any other calls? okay,
Well, listen, there it is, folks. I mean, look, if you want
exactly,
to have,
the people are thirsty for this.
No, but also, listen, it's like, you know, it speaks to the media climate we're in right now.
Right.
I mean, you could watch a very slick MSNBC show that doesn't have to rely on viewer donations. They're funded by corporate media ads.
Right.
Then you're going to be subjected to propaganda. You know, if you want. Actual outlets that provide real journalism, then it needs the support of its audience.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm grateful to that woman for calling in and giving her support.
Yeah, and we have another call. Let's see if it's about donating or a question. Hello, welcome to the Katie Halper Show.
Hey, Katie, how you doing?
Hey, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. This is Jovan from Phoenix.
Hi, Jovan.
Been following this story for a while. I've loved the work, you know, yourself and Glenn Greenwald and Aaron Mattei have done on this debunking the liberal narrative about, you know, what Russiagate was, the collusion,
right,
and all that. Just a quick question. What, in the opinion of the panel, you know, what do you think the media heads who've been pushing this farce are going to do now? I mean, we've kind of seen a little bit, especially with the Rachel Maddow show,
right,
and the continued spin, but I just wanted to hear some, you know, more thoughts and opinions on where do you think we go from here, media-wise.
Great. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
I mean, the press is like a, you know, we're like herd animals, right? So,
right,
you know, I've said this before, it's like wildebeest. If 51% of the wildebeest decide to go one way, they'll all go that way. And that's why you see these seamless transitions from, you know, thinking one thing one day, and then the next day, the new point of emphasis is going to be, we need to see the entire report from Mueller. Then once the report's in, the new point of emphasis is going to be, why isn't there an obstruction charge, despite the fact that Mueller says there is no underlying crime.
Right.
And then there's going to be calls for new investigations. They're not going to let this go. It's going to continue in perpetuity, I think. I don't know what you think, Aaron.
These people have invested so much into it. Yeah, they're forced to double down, and they're already doing that. I mean, they can't claim to be taken seriously as journalists. They're basically at this point propagandists on this issue, and hopefully they can have time to work in, focus on real issues as they continue to double down on this one. But it's just like they've painted themselves into a real corner, and it's going to be kind of both sad and hilarious to watch how they continue to try to wiggle out of it.
Right. We have a few more questions. I'm going to ask you a few more minutes, and I'm going to ask you a few more questions, but I also want to give listeners another chance. 212-209-2877. Again, that's 212-209-2877. Aaron and Matt, I want to know, have you guys experienced, like, I feel like gaslit, and you must feel especially gaslit because you guys are really – I just like interview people like you, but you guys are actually doing all the research, and you are kind of dismissed as conspiracy theorists, which is really ironic because you guys are skeptical of the conspiracy theory. How does it feel doing the work that you're doing? Like, do you feel marginalized by fellow journalists in a way that you haven't before? Is this something you've experienced? How does it compare with Iraq war skepticism, WMD skepticism?
Well, I can definitely say these last 3 years have been the most unpleasant of my career for a number of reasons, but this story was the big one. I was regularly accused of being a foreign agent.
Right.
I had people calling my house. I had people threatening me, threatening my kids.
My gosh.
I had somebody from one of these sort of self-described Russia-watching websites call me up and offer to escort me to the FBI so that I could give my confession.
Oh my gosh.
Call me in my home on my landline. The pressure that came from all sides in this business to not say anything was incredibly powerful. I think my experience is probably a little different from Aaron's because I work for, sort of massive corporate organization as well. But it was difficult operating within those parameters. Because it was assumed that I was crazy about this point, and I was definitely discouraged from ever really talking about it in public.
Right.
I want to say first, ultimately, like, my feelings don't matter, right? Because what matters is, in journalism are the facts, and the facts were always on our side. It just, and if you take journalism seriously, then even though, all these people are trying to attack you and marginalize you. I never took them seriously. It was definitely, as Matt said, it was so unpleasant, but it also honestly was kind of amusing. I felt sorry for them, that they were so in it. And I have been surprised. One thing that's been surprising is even after Mueller collapses the conspiracy theory, it's one thing if you don't want to credit people who got it right. I totally get that. For whatever reason, if you don't want to acknowledge, look, there's a small group of skeptics who have been saying this for 2 years, that the evidence was not there and it was a mistake. It's fine if you don't want to credit us. But I saw people, leftist pundits who I respect, coming out of nowhere to take shots at me and my colleagues and disingenuously accuse us of defending, of helping Trump.
Right.
And saying that we were the ones who were fixated on this issue, that we were not calling, that we were also important, which is just, meanwhile, I think not coincidentally, these are some of the same people who got this story wrong, into it, who had serious suspicions about whether Trump was compromised by Putin. I'll name one of them who came after me on Twitter, Ryan Cooper of The Week, whose work I really respect, but he came after me with, so it's like, that's the part I don't get. And, as Matt spoke about, there are incentives to going along with this, to conforming. And, I just really respect people like Matt and others who never thought twice about actually doing their jobs.
Yeah.
Being real journalists and following the facts.
Well, thank you guys so much. And I want to thank you for being so relentless and fearless. And I know, Aaron, you're saying it's just feelings, who cares? But I think it's important that people know that this is happening, because it's important to realize that when you're even assessing the media, to know that there are all these incentives against doing what you're doing, and there are all these incentives to do what the Rachel Maddows are doing. So we'd have a lot more people speaking in the way and writing in the way that you were if there weren't these incentives. And Aaron and Matt, we're going to have you back on. Matt, you have to come back on and talk about your experiences in Russia. Aaron, you have to talk more about your theory about the privilege perpetuating racket that is Russiagate for the elites.
If I can say quickly, one irony of hearing about these attacks that Matt was subjected to and being accused of being is that Matt took huge career risk to publish a vitally important journal in Russia called The Exile, where he was critical of everybody, so much so that his journal in Russia was shut down.
Right, so obviously a Putin operative. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I was gone from it by then, but we were very critical of Putin from the beginning.
The perfect plan, Matt. Thank you. Where can we find you online? Where can people find you? Because we're out of time. I want to make sure people can find you. Aaron J. Mate on Twitter. Matt, you are?
At M. Taibbi, and I'm at rollingstone.com and taibbi.substack.com.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. Thanks for listening to Katie Halper Show. You can hear the Katie Halper Show every Tuesday at 11 a.m. on WBI. That's 99.5 FM or WBI.org. Thanks again, Matt Taibbi and Aaron Mate, for talking to us. See you next week. Okay, this is like a joke. I don't know why it's the most omnidirectional microphone. Maybe because I'm using my laptop. Okay, anyway, the point is you can also find the Katie Halper Show on iTunes and SoundCloud, where the quality is usually a lot better than what I'm doing right now. And I hope you enjoyed that episode. And please become Patreon subscribers at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. And we'll be dropping a bonus interview with Matt Taibbi about media bias. Bye, thanks.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.